Messrs. Tevenet, Dowling, Sestito, and Prongs, welcome you to the Marauder's Map as we cover Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Haven't Seen It with Tim Sestito and Tommy Tevenet. Hello, everybody. Welcome on in. Thank you all so much for listening today. This is a podcast where one of us is watching a movie for the very first time, and today that is Tommy, who is the only child from the 2000s who just missed the entire Harry Potter wave, like completely just...
Always hated it.
that's a great way to start off this podcast. I always hated it.
For the Potter fans, I mean, I'm going to be the contrarian, I guess, here of the three of us with our special guest, Connor Dowling. Welcome back to the pod.
Yes, Connor Dowling, our resident. He's here to check our lore, essentially. He's our lore
check my
expert.
Negative energy.
I will check your negative energy because... Well, I asked you if you had seen Sorcerer's Stone because I feel like that's the quintessential Christmas time one of these movies. And then you're like, I've seen the first two. Yeah. And I hated them. And I was like, okay. Let's go to the best, which is Prisoner of Azkaban. Like, I think this is easily the best movie in this series. I don't even know if it's close, really. I think the film franchise has a lot more ups and downs than the books. As a book reader, Dowling, yourself, I think you would maybe also agree with that, where the quality of the movies ebb and flow much more deeply than the quality of the books do. I feel like the books are all pretty consistent. There's better ones, there's worse ones, but they're all very consistent. But the movies really ebb and flow in quality.
100%. I think most people know that, like, 5... is their least favorite. They won't say it's bad as a book.
Oh, that was an awful movie.
But
you've seen that one?
I agree the movie stinks.
The movie stinks.
The movie stinks.
Well, so I remember when we were in like Camp 78, Timmy, back in the day. I forget if you were in there with me, but there's one day where it was a rainy day. This is a summer camp we went to. And they said, let's go to the movies. And so the two choices were, this is 2007, so it was Transformers or Harry Potter 5. And I said Transformers, even though I already saw it. I was like, yeah, that rocks. And everyone else said Harry Potter. So we watched Harry Potter 5, and I was such a miserable little bitch about it. I was trying to fall asleep the whole time and, like, making a stink about it. I'd be like, oh, why doesn't it be a Harry Potter?
Tommy, you weren't a good sport about something?
Yeah.
No.
What a shocker.
But I made a good sport today, so I'm changing up my spoon, even though it still didn't change my feelings about Harry Potter.
Okay, that's interesting. I think it's good that we have a person who doesn't like Harry Potter to discuss, because I think it'll just make a more interesting conversation than us just being like, oh, this is really good.
Well, it's kind of like when we covered the other Emma Watson movie we covered, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, where both of us were like, yeah, this movie sucks, and that ended up being one of our more popular episodes. So, and multiple people told me, oh, I love that movie, and then I heard you guys shit on it the whole time. It happens.
I think the books correlate, like, with the length. The movies correlate with the book's length. The bigger the book is, the harder it is to show that in a movie. Quality drops. That's an easy metric. The first couple, great. Third, it's really good. It's a really good movie.
And I would say 4 through 6 are all like middling to poor in quality. So, like, for me, my rankings would be 3, then 7 part 1, 7 part 2, then 1, 2, and then you can rotate 6, 4, 5. You could just put all three of them at the bottom in the movie ranking. So it's not a book ranking. That's just a movie ranking.
Yeah. I love, you know, the books, it's a different story, but movies, like, the first one I thought was the truest to the books.
Easily.
It was nice.
But it's also it's probably the easiest to adapt because it's the true.
It's well done.
It's a hero story.
There's a lot of people who ended up reading the entire series just because they saw that movie and was like, oh, that's a good movie. It was a great intro to the whole world. They did a great job, you know? And then depending on what you like in the first four movies, I thought the fourth movie was pretty good.
I think it's...
Yeah,
I do, you know, not like that.
Different strokes for different folks. But first four, most people can agree, are pretty decent. I had a lot of trouble with the next four movies. I didn't care for many of them. I saw them only once.
I do remember how much of a bad sport I was at, like, when the last movie when the last movie came out. This was like my junior year of high school, so Tim's senior year. And I remember there was one night where I had my house to myself, and I was trying to get a party going. I was trying to invite Timmy and like our buddy Davey and like Tom and a bunch of others. Like, hey guys, open house tonight. Let's go out. And you guys all said no. The midnight release of Harry Potter, the final movie, is coming out. I said, fuck all you guys. Fuck Harry Potter.
Now who's the dork, Tommy? I was at the midnight release as one of
You guys are all dressed up.
Yeah.
As one of the students.
No, I was dressed up as Lupin, and I couldn't grow a mustache. And I literally drew a porn star mustache on.
Oh, my goodness.
Amazing. Meanwhile, I was stewing.
You're the odd man out, Tommy.
Tom was at the movie with us.
It was like someone else then. It was like, I think James Rimmer's with me and someone else. And I just remember being like, no one wanted to go to Harry Potter.
Nuts to that cat.
and then everyone, I remember like everyone started getting really defensive against me where I said, fuck Harry Potter. And then Davey said, no, fuck you, Tommy.
Oh, yeah. Fuck you, Tommy.
That's good advice.
Well, I think what's interesting with the Harry Potter film franchise and then 7 Part 2, where I put it up higher in my rankings, I kind of almost feel like it was the prototypical event movie. Like, we did, like, event movies didn't like, we just had blockbusters, but there wasn't really like the event movie, like an Avengers Endgame and like these just big ending movies that genre didn't really exist. And I think Harry Potter 7 Part 2 is the first like true event movie where it's this decade long thing coming to an end, and it's this culmination of all these years of books and movies and video games and merchandise and just this beloved franchise that's going on, and it all culminates here at the end of this story. And I think for, you know, us, like, who, for me, who grew up with these books, like, I read the first book probably when I was like 5 or 6, somewhere in that lane. Like, me and my family listened to the audiobooks over and over again. Like, I have Jim Dole's voice seared into my head endlessly for Jim Dale.
He was the audiobooks. Medicine man in Peach Dragon. Yeah, the Disney movie.
I do think a part of it boils down to me of being like never getting over my younger brother thing, where my sister loved the Harry Potter books and movies. And so me and my older brother were meeting like, well, fuck that then.
That's and for girls.
Yeah, exactly. Contrarian take right there, where like there's probably still some like some stuff I've gotten over. Like, I used to hate the Backstreet Boys, and I'm like, I get it. They're fun.
I love NSYNC.
I do remember on road trips, we would like, my sister sometimes would make us like switch from music that my brother and I were listening to. She'd be like, can we listen to Harry Potter audiobooks? We're like, what the hell is this shit? Immediately. We would be like, going from like rocking out to like, I don't know, like Queen in the car or something like that, to then like switching to like Harry Potter.
Chapter 24. And
you're like, oh, this is so boring. There's my Harry Potter hate take.
I'm a super dork. I suggest the Stephen Fry English version, where it's got a little bit more lit to it, and it makes a difference. And I've listened to those audiobooks with my entire family. It's some of my most cherished moments. We're driving like 9 hours, get a couple hours of Harry Potter. Couple hours of Harry Potter means couple hours of silence. You can't buy that.
You can buy. Yeah. You can buy Harry Potter audio tapes.
No, but I mean, you got to set the hook. You got to set the hook.
Let me make a joke. Let me make a joke. There, okay? Sometimes my humor is dry and witty, and just let me make the joke there. But all right, before we fully dive into Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, what have you fellas watched recently? Anything interesting strike your fancy?
I'll start. I had a killer of a weekend. So first off, Friday night, turns out Yale is doing a 35mm screening of Die Hard, the original Die Hard.
Oh, yeah.
On film. Went to go see that with my friends and my girlfriend. The next night, another theater near me was doing a double feature of Die Hard 2 and Lethal Weapon. So I just was like fully in the midst of 80s like cop action movies. And it just rocked. I mean, Die Hard, especially the original Die Hard, is a classic movie. I mean, it's a Christmas
perfect
movie.
Perfect.
It's perfect. It's amazing.
With action for the season. Unbelievable. Yeah.
And it just plays so well. And like, it's so funny, like the scenes that people are cheering for. And it was funny because like it was a screening. Yale does these free screenings. Like every semester, and a lot of times it's really cool movies. And a lot of times you also get young kids that come into it. Like I remember like Terminator 2, some kid was taking notes next to me because it was for his class. I was like, what the hell? When they did that. And for Die Hard, the guy who introduced the film, he asked, now who here hasn't seen Die Hard? And I'm thinking like most people are going to like not raise their hands. And then I'd say like probably like 70% of the crowd raised their hands. And I was like, oh, we're in for one right now. And it just like for a crowd that mostly hasn't seen Die Hard, it just played so well, so much fun, so amazing. Everyone cheered when Reginald Bell Johnson shot the bad guy at the end of the movie. And it was like, everyone's like, yeah, let's go. It's just a funny cheer moment. Yeah. And then, then that was Die Hard. And then the next night, Die Hard 2, seeing those two movies back to back is really funny. Die Hard 2 is probably the worst of the original sequels, but it's still really fun. And because a lot of it is that it just like, has too much like shoe lever of being like, oh, well, everyone's back. We're going to have Reginald Bell Johnson have a scene. We're going to have William Atherton have a scene back. But it was one of those movies that like this crowd for the Die Hard 2 Lethal Weapon screening were so rowdy that it was just like everyone was dying at every stupid fucking run liner. Like when William Sadler, who's the villain in Die Hard 2, at one point a reporter comes up to him and said, hey, can we get a word? He said, yeah, two words, fuck and you. And everyone's like, yeah, let's go. We were all in it. We were all just like completely locked in. And it's the perfect environment to see that movie in. Because there's so many ridiculous moments where at one point, like Bruce Willis, John McClane is in like a plane and all the villains throw all their grenades inside said plane. So then John McClane has to think on his feet and then he has to go into the plane's ejector seat and it ejects while an explosion falls right before. And when that happened, we were all just like, This rocks. Let's go. And it's just such a funny follow-up. And then End the Night of Lethal Weapon, like the ideal buddy cop movie. Just so much fun. Just a blast right there. Just the saxophone, the Shane Blackness of it all. Mel Gibson being crazy in a fun way. Not like today, in a non-fun way. But just and every time Danny Glover said, I'm too old for this shit, everyone in the crowd broke out in the cheers or like, let's go. He's too old. Yeah. The perfect environment to see those movies in. So if you ever get the chance to see those three movies, Die Hard, Die Hard 2, and Lethal Weapon in theaters, go do it. You'll have a blast.
It sounds like the Rocky Horror Picture Show of those movies, which sounds like a good time.
Yeah, yeah. Very much.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Dowling?
Yeah. Okay. So I was listening to, a couple weeks ago episode where you were talking about 12 Monkeys, where they were saying the nominees for the best supporting actor. And one of them was Tim Roth for Rob Roy. And I happen to have seen that in theaters and know it's an amazing movie. I saw it when I was young. What year was 12 Monkeys? Like 95.
95. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So I was like 13. So like middle school. It was a rated R movie. Went with my grandma. This is a masterpiece. It is an all-star cast. You got Liam Neeson. You got Brian Cox. You got Jessica Lange. You got Tim Roth, John Hurt. Like, James Spader's in it. Like, it's...
That's an all-star cast.
Yeah, no, I'm not kidding. So it's a kind of fictionalized account of this Scottish hero, figure like early 1700s. He's like the head of his clan. They raise cattle. They sell it. The English are there. No one likes them, blah, blah, blah. So he borrows some money, and this noble's nephew, who's a real shitbird, played by Tim Roth, literally one of the most despicable characters ever put to film, he finds out that Liam Neeson's making this big deal for a head of cattle, and he's borrowing like $8,000, like enough for like a village, you know, and Tim Roth kills his man and robs him of $8,000. This goes wrong, that goes wrong, and eventually, like, he puts pressure on Liam Neeson, freaking burns his freaking whole lords and stuff, rapes his wife, Jessica Lange. He comes back, seeks freaking asylum. It ends in a freaking duel to the death. And Liam Neeson's got a big... Liam Neeson already knew how to work the lightsaber props in Phantom Menace because of this movie. And you can tell he spent a long time studying it. And Tim Roth has a freaking rapier. And I'm telling you, it's one of the best dueling scenes in movie history. I rewatched it just to make sure the memory was as good as, you know, it actually was.
Making sure the nostalgia glasses weren't on.
Oh, dude.
Dallin, I do have to love that we offhand mentioned like maybe like that movie for like a second on our pod.
That's a forgotten movie.
That was verbatim the line.
Literally, we said it was a forgotten movie.
And I, in such a contrarian way, was like, no, I remember that movie and it was dope. I texted you guys.
You texted me about it and I was like, what are you talking about? You said you mentioned the pod. I was like, I don't remember saying that. Like that, like one like random line I said in the pod for like a second where I was like, Rob Roy.
I'm like, yes, no, it is not forgotten. I thought Tim Roth should have won because, oh my God, it had my dear grandmother cursing him. And she didn't curse. And she goes, that bastard. Like, and I've never heard my grandmother swear before in my life. Ever. My dear Irish grandmother.
That's an Irish grandmother right there. Doesn't ever.
That's a movie we'll have to cover eventually, probably.
You have to. The venom was dripping from her. That bastard. And I was like, oh my God, like this could be the best acting.
Maybe we have a forgotten classics moment.
No, it was a real good one. And I rewatched it. Tommy, there is some breath in there, but the action hopefully draws you back in. Like it breathes a little bit, but there's some freaking masterpiece acting scenes in it. It's a real good one, dude.
So,
and the ending, oh, you feel good about the ending. It's all right. It's a banger. Yeah. Okay, sorry. Taking off the Rob Roy kilt.
gotta slip the kilt off.
One of the most popular reviews on Letterboxd is he has a very particular set of kilts.
Oh.
So I went to the theater with my girlfriend. We're trying to really get in the holiday spirit this year. And we went and saw How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the Jim Carrey version, classic, like... I definitely have childhood nostalgic glasses for this movie. Jim Carrey just puts that movie on his back and
eats it up.
Wait, you heard that like he had to get like Navy SEAL training,
CIA training, torture training to apply the makeup.
Like twirling pebbles and stuff. Like, think about puppies. Like, that's horrible.
Because there's a story that came out recently. Not to interrupt you, Tim, but Jim Carrey almost quit the movie and almost said to like Brian Glazer and Ron Howard, "Here, I'll take back my $25 million. I don't know if I can do this movie. This whole makeup process is torturous."
Yeah, and I mean, it was like 8 hours in the chair every day. Like, that is arduous. That is grueling. I mean,
above and beyond.
It still looks great. like the makeup does. I think the film itself, like,
it's kind of mediocre.
It should be more colorful. Yeah, it's got that Christmas charm to it that I think that draws them back to it. The one thing I wanted to note, which I've seen this movie before, I never noticed this before, is that there's a scene where, like, they show the babies arriving, and like how like all the babies come, and it's basically like the stork scene, but they just come down with like umbrellas. And then there's one moment where like guy picks it up, honey, we got our baby. Wow, he looks like your boss, that's a joke you don't get as a kid for sure. And then the second one is like where the house that the Grinch comes out, it's like, we were actually having a party. And it just shows a bunch of people throwing keys in a fishbowl, which if you're not aware of what a key party is, it's a swinging event.
Amazing.
And we'll leave it at that. And I'm like, that, I can't believe they put that in this movie. Like, that is such a, like, that's a joke that completely goes over your head as a kid. You have no idea what it means. You're just like watching it. That one's a wink, wink, nod, nod for mom and dad there. But I was like,
wow,
stunned that was in the movie. That was kind of my big takeaway, because I've seen the movie enough that I was like, yeah, I know this movie, but it's a Christmas classic. And I have nostalgic for it. I feel like I'd probably be much harsher on the movie if I didn't have nostalgia for it. Yeah. That's kind of my take on it.
Me, it's, I always love the Dr. Seuss, Boris Karloff one.
Oh yeah, like that's the classic
one.
Yeah, that's a classic.
And I was a little older when the Carrie one came out, so I never had the, like, I appreciate what he did. He's great in it. But I was always like, give me I want all the Who's singing.
It's kind of
glory. Yes.
It's kind of a tough adaptation to ask to make like a 20-page children book into a 90-minute movie. And yeah, like, I think they did a bang up job there. Like, in terms of, it's just like, what can you do?
Yeah. At least they didn't Cat in the Hat it. Like, that is a train wreck.
It could have been way worse.
Yeah, it could have went way worse.
Well, The Grinch is a movie, this version of The Grinch is a movie I came to late in life. I only watched it like for the first time like 6 or 7 years ago. And there's there's a lot of padding out of the story right there.
Yeah, you mean the whole movie?
Yeah.
The whole movie is a padding out. That's basically, you had to do it. You had to get to the 90-minute runtime. And they did that effectively.
The original padding out from the story was, here, we'll just have them sing a lot more, and then we can make a half an hour cartoon. And then they're like, you know what? We can stretch this into a movie. So, like, of course, it's going to be really threadbare at some points, you know? Like, half an hour cartoon, perfect.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. But that is our recap of the movies we watched recently. But the movie we all watched is Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
The ride of the summer is coming. Mind your head. On June 4th, old friends return.
Ridiculous.
New dangers await. And the Prisoner of Azkaban escapes. Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Housekeeping.
This film is not yet rated.
Oh, come.
All right. Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban is a 2004 fantasy film directed by Alfonso Cuarón from a screenplay by Steve Coles. It is based on the 1999 novel of the same name by J.K. Rowling. It stars Daniel Radcliffe as Harry Potter, alongside Rupert Grint as Ron Weasley, Emma Watson as Hermione Granger. It chronicles Harry's third year at Hogwarts and his quest to uncover the truth about his past, including the connection to recently escaped Azkaban prisoner Sirius Black that he has to Harry and his deceased parents. So this is, I think, probably the biggest shift in the film franchise of this. And I want to make this note clear here. I think we were talking about it beforehand. I'm not sure if I really touched upon it here. For Dowling and I, who are fans of the books, fans of the movies, there's a big belief that it's like, oh, if you've seen the Harry Potter movies, you've read the books. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think one and two are really, really close. And then the further along they get, the farther they stray from the books at all.
Agreed.
So I kind of view the metrics of the books and the movies on different scales. Like, obviously, I'm taking into account what they're able to adapt from the books into the movies, but like, there are different things that need to be done in film adaptation to books, where it's like you get the same scene, but it's done differently. Like, I think the biggest one in this one, because I didn't have time to read The Prisoner of Azkaban, but I did read about like the differences like between the books and the movie, and one of the big ones, and it's one of the big standout scenes, I think, for me in this movie, where you kind of see the Harry Potter film elevated to this cinematic quality and level that the Christopher Columbus movies didn't have, and none of the following films have, which is, for me, the big reason why this one stands out as easily the best of the film franchise. The one where Mr. Weasley tells Harry about Sirius Black, and it's done in this one long take in the Leaky Cauldron, and it's just fantastic. And the framing of like the Sirius Black poster and how it changes as like the camera just keeps slowly moving there, and it's all done in this one take. It's so excellent. In the book, it was like Harry hearing Mr. and Mrs. Weasley arguing about it, and like, and they got the same scene across, but they changed it, and
it gave it a cool dark tone in the shot. It gave it, like, if Tarantino was filming the Inglourious Bastards bar scene, it had a very similar dark, like,
quality
one
to
shot
it.
Yeah, and it's like focus on the character. Totally, it was done very well.
Well, there's something about like the first two Christopher Columbus movies, which I watched for the first time like 6 years ago. I think I saw the first one in theaters and hated it. But I watched them again 6 years ago. I just thought they were just boring slogs, if I'm being honest. And not to hate too much.
But I despise them.
But fuck them. No, but Christopher Columbus was originally signed on to direct all the Harry Potter movies. And then he realized by doing so, he would miss out on seeing his children grow up. And he was like, I'm going to pass on directing this, the future movies. So he stayed on for like producers for this movie. Then the shooting wrapped. He decided to end his involvement with the franchise right after this. So they had to scramble and find a new director. So first up, they offered Guillermo del Toro. And Guillermo del Toro wanted more of a Dickinson version of the stories. He thought the first two films were too bright and happy and full of light. So he's like, I'm done. Mark Foster turned this down, because he made Finding Neverland, and M. Night Shyamalan was considered to direct, but he turned it down because he was working on The Village at the time.
Thanks.
So Warner Brothers then composed of three different directors for their shortlist to replace Christopher Columbus. One was Kelly Currer, who I'm not sure she wrote Thelma and Louise, Kenneth Branagh, and Alfonso Cuarón. Cuarón was originally like not really familiar with the Harry Potter. He never really read the novels. He didn't see the first two movies when he was offered the job director. And Guillermo del Toro said, don't be stupid, read them immediately. He's like, read them? He's like, all right, men.
Yeah. And they definitely made the right choice here. I mean, I look at the first two, and to quote you, Tommy, the Christopher Columbus ones feel like we have Steven Spielberg at home. They definitely have that quality to them where it's like, if Steven Spielberg directed those movies, they are like all timers. You know what I mean? But it's,
well, you could probably say about Christopher Columbus's career in general.
pretty much. Yeah. Like all of his like really well-known and renowned pictures are.
So Home Alone?
Home Alone. But people quoted as John Hughes, and then it's the Harry Potter movies, but that's like J.K. Rowling, and like the directors don't really come into account there. I get what you're saying, where like Guillermo del Toro and like other people are saying like, oh, like the first two were too kiddie or whatever, but it's like those books were pretty straight adaptations, and they were kiddier. Like those were written as children's novels
on purpose. Like I think by design the series is set to grow with you. Like, you know, I each of my kids, like, we didn't read them at the, you know, I tried to group some when I could, but like, you know, when you're like eight, I'm going to read you the first one because you can get it. And you, I can show you some concepts. But when you start introducing darker tones, and this is, you start to see a little bit in the secrecy in the second book, like you, we might not know what's going on. And this, there's certainly that just kind of air of like unknown. And you could tell in the filming too. It's just, it's darker. It's more, you know, dank.
You can kind of tell that the good times of, I think pretty primarily like the first one, where the first one is like, this is the greatest place on earth. This is a good time, which I think is the,
well,
for you, Tommy, where it's like, You don't do well with fantasy at all. Like,
yeah,
you're not a fantasy guy at all.
The only exception is Princess Bride, but
that's like that's a fairy tale. That's
a masterpiece.
But like worlds like this are not. But it's if you had to, like, there's always that dumb question that'll pop
up. Princess Bride's a superhero movie. It's not like, you know, it truly is like. They're going to win. You know, it's a rom-com superhero movie. That's also a comedy.
For you, you don't care about lore. You don't care about world building. Like, I'm not a big lore guy, but I like a nice world. And Harry Potter is
one
like
sets the tone.
It's the quintessential, like,
you're
if you had to pick one fantasy world to live in, this is the one. Okay. This is the most pleasant one for sure.
Wizard Harry. Yes. That's the one you want.
I'll gladly be a muggle and just like be not aware
you,
of
you
any
are
of
Vernon. You are Vernon Dursley of this podcast.
Good
you
call. You are the Vernon Dursley of this podcast.
He was the like fat kid.
No, that's Dudley. Dudley.
He's the uncle. Dad. Uncle Vernon.
Yeah.
The guy uncle with the mustache. Vernon.
Okay, yeah. I'll be the uncle. I'll put Harry in the closet.
Yes, that's you.
the cupboard under the stairs, Tommy.
Come on, if you're gonna get this,
my reference wasn't accurate enough for you.
I didn't want to be the corrector, but yes,
Richard
number
Griffiths,
four Pivot Drive. The cover.
Tim is used
stairs.
To being correct on this podcast, and now this podcast.
I know I get to correct you. Tables have turned for sure. I mean, Richard Griffiths 100%. As Uncle Vernon is one of those. It's such a heat check performance every time he's in the movies. Dude. Like, he's just perfect. He's
well. It's funny that his like whole role throughout the film series is like, here's how you get fucked with this time.
Oh yeah, I don't like you at all. I'm completely forward about it, and like, you're lucky you're here, boy. It's horrible, and luckily it's high fantasy, but Harry is the definition of an abused child, physically, verbally, emotionally, neglectfully, like literally poster child, abused child. Like, if I knew about that as a teacher and didn't report it, I would go to prison. Abused. It's wild. And Uncle Vernon does a great job of it. Where he's like,
this, yeah, he's like, just fuck off. And then this one, yeah, they have the aunt.
We have to pay for him again, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
They're just in the first scene when Harry has his anger release and blows up his aunt, which is done great. And again, another little change from the books to the movies here. It's like, she stays a week, but this is just a day visit. Because you know what? Like,
perfect.
Like, we get,
it doesn't change the story.
It doesn't perfect change the edit. Story at all. Perfect little change there. And then Harry takes his wand. And this is where I thought for you, Tommy, you might get into it a little more, where it's like this movie has such an energy to it, and it comes immediately with the arrival of the night bus, when Harry sticks out his wand and that purple triple decker bus shows up. And again, another little change where like Ernie is like the bus driver's just a guy, and then in this one he's just like this little talking head that controls this other guy, like, yeah it's a good cute. Way like it's well, just
there's one thing that's great about that, the whole Ernie thing, is I see this pop up on Twitter a lot, that people always lament about like the lack of like DVD menus and how creative they used to be, where people point out the Prisoner of Azkaban DVD would have like the talking shrunken head thing be like the DVD nice menu touch. And stuff
if
like
you,
that.
If you want to talk about DVD menus, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone had the greatest DVD menu of all time. you got to explore the castle. They had games. You had to find the mirror of Erised to watch the DVD, to watch the deleted scenes of the movie. Like, you had to go through and, like, manually explore the castle. Like, you could spend an hour on a DVD menu. Like, that is insane to think about.
It's insane. The art of DVD menus was just, like, such a great thing. Where, like, I watched, like, Beverly Hills Cop 2 on DVD. And it would be like you're going into like a briefcase file and like you're looking into different stuff and all that stuff. And nowadays, like, you know, 4Ks are still a thing and Blu-rays are still a thing, but most of the menus are just a picture of Eddie Murphy and just says play. And that's it. That's all you're going to get.
All Blu-rays have pictures of Eddie Murphy, whether or not he's in the movie or not.
Yeah.
But there's pros and cons to each because, yes, being able to find that every now and then or a cool Easter egg in like the Borat one or like any other neat things, you'd get the negative where people wouldn't think about the replay screen if you were like watching a DVD. Like, yeah. I have more than once fallen asleep throwing on the Newsies and then woken up because the replay scene is them just going, and the world will know, like screaming at the top of any, like. And that would just play and like jolt you awake. And you're like, that was dumb. Never watching that DVD again, ever.
That's amazing.
And it's like waking up in the drinks dream sequence of Twin Peaks.
Dude, that was one of the most terrifying moments of my life, falling asleep to a show that I wasn't sure I liked and had to be talked into. Like, the only one that's okay was Mulholland Drive. And I do like that one now. But I woke up. I awake to someone violently punching a girl in the face over and over again. And I'm like, guess what? Never watching this show again.
Done immediately. That'd be so traumatizing. But I remember like cool shit like the Shaun the Dead DVD, which I like wore out. And it would be like Sean walking up to the Winchester. That's how the DVD menu started. And nowadays, the 4K for it is literally just a picture of Sean and Ned. And it's just like,
It's not worth the money to develop into it for the number of sales you're going to get.
And probably people, like these new discs take up so much more memory space.
The other thing you had to think about was the televisions. You couldn't just keep a blank picture because you would get screen burn on the old TVs. So they made it so like something was playing or cycling or doing something enough to keep it going on a lot of these. Like that was part of it.
To end this tangent, I think one we have to shout out and the goat of this is Shrek 2's DVD. Mm-hmm. It has like an American Idol type thing where it was all the Shrek characters.
Yes,
like, I remember that. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, unbelievable. I was going to shout it out if you didn't, but... Yeah, the lost art of the DVD menu sounds like a YouTube video I would probably watch. I'm not going to lie.
We should make that podcast or make that special.
That's actually not a bad idea.
Video essay.
Yeah. We'll come in with the couples.
As I get us off the rails of talking about anything but Harry Potter.
So Tommy, what
it's an immediate sigh.
What don't you like about Harry Potter? Like, what is it for you that just makes you go like, fuck this?
I just find it boring. I don't know. It just doesn't connect with me in a way. And I think it's just too, like, just, I don't know.
The three main characters?
You've been doing this podcast.
Three main characters? Like, anything?
Well, no. I'm trying to like comprehend. I think a lot of it is I just find like the whole like pacing of these movies like just not like really engaging for me. I find them just kind of just like taking you out. I don't find the characters that compelling. I think also it's just very British in a way that's not fun for me.
That's what it is. Tommy doesn't like the Brits.
Well, hey, I love Shaun the Dead. Love the Simon Pegg movies.
He's an anti-Britite.
This is my friend Shaun of the Dead. We've been friends for a long time.
Okay,
exactly.
I'm not letting Tommy go on a tangent about his favorite movie of all time. Okay, he just doesn't get that.
Mm-mm.
I think that for me, part of it is just like there's something in this series that just doesn't connect. I never really found like high fantasy engaging for me or anything like that. A lot of it, like old timey stuff and the magic and everything like that, it just doesn't really trickle my fancy and stuff like that. When I was a kid, I was much more into the Marvel of it all and like the DC of it all, like comic book, like superheroes and stuff. And that really got me going. Whereas like when I think of like Harry Potter and stuff like that, I just found like, I just remember the first movie thinking I was so boring when I was like in like fifth grade or first grade when it came out. And it never really connected to me. And it's weird that like for a franchise that never connected to me, this is a funny thing that I was in second grade and third grade. And I think until like fifth grade, I had Harry Potter glasses. And those are the glasses I wore when I first wore glasses. So I thought they looked good on me. And I was, I remember thinking like, oh, this is cool. This is awesome. Yet, meanwhile, I did not connect with the franchise whatsoever. And part of it was also a little bit of a contrarian thing. But years later, I, you know, 25 years on, I can appreciate something my sister liked at the time. But for this, just, I see it, I get bored.
So,
I don't know.
So then, immediately. So then this movie just bored you completely?
Not completely. I think that this was better than the first two movies. The first two movies I remember being just not engaging and just like too, like almost like Guillermo del Toro was saying, too whimsical in a way that was just not fun for me. Whimsical can be good, but I don't know. When like the first movie has a whole tangent on Quidditch, I'm like, I don't really give a shit about this game to whatsoever. It's taking me out.
It's a wizarding sport.
Yeah.
It's the sport of the wizarding world. It's to build up the world. Building.
Well, then I think of the millennial thing of like people trying to do Quidditch
on a college campus, like with broomsticks between their legs. Yeah, that's embarrassing. Yeah,
and I'm like, this is just the lamest thing I ever fucking seen in my life, right there. Well, if we talk about Quidditch real quick, I do appreciate this movie's darker. You know, it's darker because Quidditch is done during a rainstorm this time, and there's no rain delay in Quidditch. Like, what's the like commissioner of Quidditch say? It's like, oh, thunderstorms, fair play. Is that okay?
No, it's about safety. Like, if you can,
well, what's the
and if it starts, it's, you know, it's got to be really hard pressed to stop it, you know.
There's a lot of scheduling involved, or it's just like, oh, well, you know, yeah. Quidditch is coming up in this campus next week, so we can't do it.
There's many instances of fights breaking out between houses because both had booked the Quidditch pitch for practice at the same time.
Yeah. It's very big. It's very big in the wizarding world.
Huge, baby.
It's a way to build some sort of game, which is basically like handball with baseball and
faster than hockey.
Faster. Like, it's got a little bit of hockey to it. It's just like, yeah. And then you just put the typical thing of like how do we? Because you know the first one is trying to get all these like. Fantasy tropes in there. How do we get flying broomsticks in there? Witches fly broomsticks. Okay, well, in this world, they play sport on brooms, and like, because that's the only instance of flying in the first one. Like the later ones, there's more flying instances, but that's probably the reason it's there.
It's awesome, man.
And it's cool. Like she came up with a whole freaking sport.
Witches learn how to ride a broom, or the parents teach him, or they take in driver's ed. You know, it's a cool way to do it.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Never connected. I know there was like a GameCube game of Quidditch.
That game rocked.
Yeah. Never really played it. The only game I played was a Game Boy Advance game, whatever, or something. But I do want to talk about Michael Gambon being Dumbledore. Gambon. As Dumbledore, the original choice for Dumbledore to replace Richard Harris was Sir Ian McKellen. And on top of like having appeared as like Gandalf from Lord of the Rings and like that being just a repeat kind of, he said, I had enough trouble living up to one legend. Two would be too much to hope for. He said it would also be inappropriate to take Richard Harris's role, as Richard Harris once called McKellen a dreadful actor.
Richard Harris loved to drink, so you never know.
Whenever I think of Richard Harris, I'm sure most people think of Dumbledore, but I always think of him as British Bob in Unforgiven. As the guy who tells all the telltales and gets the shit beat out of him by Gene Hackman at the end.
I think we talk about the shift in tone in this one. Like, I think like the Richard Harris to Michael Gambon is the thing that most audiences will be able to connect with the shift of it, because the Richard Harris Dumbledore is a lot closer to the book adaptation of Albus Dumbledore, where this one kind of loses that, like, he, in the books, he's very, like, this, like, very mystical, always calm, always collected, always cool, like, soft-spoken, but wise character. And Michael Gambon one kind of brings this intensity to him that he definitely does not have in the books, but I think it kind of works for the movies in a way, like just the movies itself, because like when the stories start to become more and more intense and the stakes start to get higher and higher and they stop being these like little whimsical, like fantasy school adventures, and the world starts to come more and more influenced into the Harry Potter series. Like in the film adaptation, I don't necessarily know if the Michael Gambon one is as bad as like true bookheads will make it out to be. Like, I think it works if you just take the movies on themselves versus if you try to isolate it from the books versus the film adaptation.
He's like more warm the books overall.
I wouldn't even call him warm. He's more sage.
Warm. Austere. Stoic.
Stoic, yeah. Sage. He's got it. It's a twinkle in the eyes, right? Yes. Like that's the description of him.
You know he's on your side and you know you're going to be safe. And it's just he's the goat.
I think Harris had that. That quality that Gambon does not have at all. I think what's interesting about this one is the first two have their own distinct style, and then three through the sevens have their own visual distinct style, and like three really establishes that look, like the printing of the text. That's like going to be in all the papers and stuff like that. Just the way the castle looks and stuff. It's all established in The Prisoner of Azkaban. It's really a reset of the film world, because those first two just feel like, Tommy, you haven't seen the rest of them. The first two feel completely isolated in like a box compared to rest of the films.
They definitely feel more like kids' movies it goes on. I guess this is a point to like talk about like the central cast right here. I do want to mention Alfonso Cuarón. When he first came on this movie, he in order to acquaint himself with the three lead actors and actresses, he had each of them write an essay about their characters, and from a first person point of view. So Emma Watson, in the Hermione type fashion, went overboard and wrote a 16-page essay. Daniel Radcliffe did
a page and a half. Yeah.
Yeah. And Rupert Grint never turned his in.
Because he said Ron would never.
Ron wouldn't have done it.
Yeah. Convenient excuse there, Rupert Grint.
Brilliant. Well, win the game. Like, think outside the box.
That'd be me. Well, my character wouldn't do this.
And also, not for nothing, he's not replacing Ron Weasley in the cast if he doesn't turn in this essay. You imagine going to Warner Brothers with your billion-dollar franchise being like, oh, this kid actor didn't write a voluntary essay on his character. We need to recast him. And they're like, are you out of your mind?
No. Yeah. That's thinking fourth dimensionally. Like, you're like, I'm not doing this, and here's why. Checkmate, my friend. Well done. Yeah. He's always been good at chess.
Okay, so we've been talking a lot about, like, let's talk about the movie itself. Because, like, I feel like the only scene we've really covered is the ant getting blown up and the Sirius Black. Like, we haven't talked about anything else. I know, Tommy. But we're 50 minutes in. We're 50 minutes in.
Let me start a little bit. It's like, what a great way to kick things off and get the ball rolling. Everyone's had the dinner where you get so angry you're about to do something. Then, like, the roller, you know, like, you're so mad at a relative, you're like, I'm going to leave. Like, his just is a little more on steroids, and the police are involved. What a way to get it going. And then, like, it certainly sets the dark tone of this whole movie. But
Tommy, I'm surprised for you. You know, you're saying, like, the first two are, like, slow, methodical. Like, I feel like this one has a real urgency to it that the remainder of the movies actually, I would say, try, except for 7 Part 1, try to capture and do not capture well at all. And I think this is a testament to Alfonso Cuarón. Like,
yeah,
like he went on to have a fantastic career after this. Like, this is the movie that you make that lets you be able to go to the other studio, to the rest of the studios, and go, I've made a financially viable product. Now let me make my thing.
Yep.
Let me make the thing that I want.
He has never done an IP movie since. Alfonso Cuarón.
Yeah. I'm guessing he didn't really have any interest in doing this other than probably being told, like, hey, just do this one. Do it really well. You'll have a movie in your belt bag that's made all this money. Guillermo
del Toro was like, you'll make a lot of money.
Yeah, you'll make a lot of money. Just you'll live comfortably.
Well, and you're going to be great.
It's all gravy from this point on.
With biscuit wheels.
But I think
In terms of the tone, like I do like some of the stuff and like the little tertiary stuff where I don't remember this in the first two movies, but I love like the wanted poster of Sirius Black and how he's built up in this movie and how majority of times you see him built up is like almost like a holographic image type thing where you see like the poster and he keeps on like the movement going in and out over and over again. Oh, that's a really cool like director's touch where it makes like the mystery of who Sirius Black is compelling, which unfortunately I think once Sirius Black's introduced, it falls flat on its face. Because like Dan was saying earlier before we started recording,
well, let him make this point. Let him make.
Yeah, no, it's all right. We could talk about it. Hit it, Tommy. Yeah. I'll listen. Yeah. I won't jump in.
I think that Gary Oldman. I was thinking like, oh, Gary Oldman's in this movie. This is probably gonna be amazing. This is probably gonna be like maybe this will win me over. And instead, it was just not memorable at all for me. It was just a whatever type thing. You know,
well, this was the time where every renowned British actor was just getting involved in the Harry Potter franchise. Like it was like they didn't even have a choice. It was like state appointed.
And for Gary Oldman, he straight up said he accepted the role because he needed the work and he hadn't acted for over a year. And he wanted to take the role to please his sons, too. And like you could kind of tell the passion wasn't there for him.
It shows so much. Gary Oldman is one of my favorite actors of all time. Even when he's in a bit part, I love him. I loved him in bad movies. He's great. And it feels like he didn't read the books. And like to play someone as integral as Sirius Black, you have to. Someone as important as integral as Sirius Black, like I wish he just would have. I felt like he didn't care. I felt like I saw him just cash in the check. And I think he could have knocked it out of the park, but there was a lot of overacting in places. There was a lot of just like psychotic craziness when you didn't need it.
And it's a departure of the character in the books because the whole hype is that Sirius Black is Harry Potter's godfather. He betrayed Harry's parents, told Voldemort where the parents' location was. He's the first person to ever escape from the wizarding prison of Azkaban. And now he's on the run to hunt down and kill Harry Potter, right? Like, that's the plot of the whole movie.
Perfect.
In the books, he's a much more stoic character. He's much more calm and reserved towards Harry versus... this one, when we get to the Shrieking Shack, which is like this really exciting moment where we go through the Whopping Willow. One of the things I actually really love, like just little minute details, because the Harry Potter books always take place during the four seasons. You have your fall, winter, spring, summer. It's almost four acts, right? And you just, each time you know you're going into like an act change, essentially, is that the movie just shows the Whopping Willow, the crazy tree that's parked up there, just changing the season, shedding its leaves, shedding growing leaves, whatever. It's just very nice visual distinction.
It's the quarters of the school year, you know?
Yeah.
It's perfect.
But like none of the other movies do anything clever like that. You know, like it's just these little like clever moments in this that
I think it's the upgrade of having Cuarón in the movie.
Oh yeah. Oh, he's the star of the show in this one. Like,
yeah,
spoiler alerts for the section, but he's the reason that this movie, I think, stands above all the others. I think it's the, like, I don't know if Prisoner of Azkaban would be a lot of people's favorite book, but I think it's a lot of people's favorite movie of the Harry Potter franchise.
I could see that.
Yeah, yeah, that feels fair.
And I also think this narrative is interesting too, because it's the only one where Voldemort is not the adversary.
Yes.
Like, it's all the other ones, Voldemort is the man behind the scenes.
Numero uno.
And then J.K. Rowling gets to use her favorite plot device, which is a red herring. She loves her red herrings in her stories.
They're great.
They're in, like, pretty much all of them.
Everything.
There's a red herring in almost all every Harry Potter story.
Red,
there's
crimson, always some scarlet, vermilion, all the herrings.
Yes, it's always somebody who you think is a good guy is a bad guy. Somebody who's a bad guy is actually a good guy. Like, it's there in pretty much all of these movies,
totally.
and books. And I think this one works to the most effective of its thing, because Ron, Rat, Scat, I think this is the most effective red herring she does in any of them. Because Ron has this, you know, he's from a poor family. He has this garden rat, Scabbers. He's just been kind of like a throwaway character for the first two.
Hand-me-down.
We get a little bit more. He's a hand-me-down rat. And then it turns out that he's Peter Pettigrew, Wormtail from the James Potter, Harry's dad's crew of high school friends. And he was actually the one that betrayed Harry's parents and let Sirius Black take the blame for it. And Sirius Black has been stemming in prison for however 12, 13 years, whatever it is. He's been stewing in this prison cell, just like waiting for it. And I think it's the most effective of the red herrings. Like, all the other ones are kind of like, oh, okay. Like, all of this is starting to connect together. Like, I think of the Mad-Eye Moody, Barty Crouch one, but it's not really...
Well, the tidal wave of emotions that hits you, that the person you hate most in the world, the one who you think is responsible for your parents dying, actually is the only one who knows you're in danger and is trying to save you. And is trying to save you so bad, he's the only one to ever break out of prison. Like, that devotion, and it's like, oh my God, like, and it becomes his like, he tries to use it as his happy memory to save him. Like, I'm gonna go live with him. I don't need to go back to the cupboard under the stairs. It's such a roller coaster. And then to just see him again and be like, oh my God, someone loves me, and to have him snatched away at the end, it's a really well done emotional roller coaster
where he escapes, but Harry doesn't get what he wants.
Yeah, you don't get what you want. You're not meant to be happy.
You get half. You don't get 100%, which is a good life lesson in a children's story too.
Well, it's starting up the scary. So,
Tommy, let me ask you, because there's time travel becomes a big proponent of this one. How did that land for you? Because, like, for me, I tend to just not question, like, time travel, if you think about time travel for more than a second, it ruins everything.
It was fun in this movie. It was charming. I mean, they basically just did a riff on Back to the Future 2, being honest, right here. And, like, I think the funniest part of it was Hermione being like, oh, like, I didn't know how the back of my hair looked. Is that how the back of my hair looks or something?
But I loved how they foreshadowed it, especially in this movie. Like, they did such a good job. The one scene with the boggart in the cupboard where Harry sees the Dementor, and they're all doing the spell to get rid of the boggart. And I noticed Alfonso Cuarón loves moving the camera through glass in this one. He really loves pushing that camera through windows and mirrors and having it come into the classroom. But you come in through the mirror there and you push through, and you just see Harry and Ron and all the other classmates, and then the camera keeps pushing to the side, and then all of a sudden Emma Watson's in the frame, and they're all just like, where did you come from? And, like, you know, on your first watch, you're probably just sitting there being like, okay, got it, yep, okay, establishing shot. You're not even thinking about Hermione not being in that shot, and then when you say it, you're like, why are they making such a big deal about it? And then you learn that it's this time-traveling device that she's been taking so she can take all these classes that are overlapping. She's really trying to cram
push
it all
herself.
to push herself to be the true know-it-all that she is.
Yeah, it's well done.
It's very well done. In there, I one of the other things I really loved, and this is during the time traveling section when they go back to push it in. Tommy, you okay?
Yeah, I'm good. Slumping.
You're slumping. You're slumping. I'm trying to keep you engaged here.
I'll still talk.
But
what do you need?
But like
when the first podcast, you hear me snoring.
Yeah. Tell us how you really feel.
Get a CPAP.
But the when they start the time traveling section and they go back, it goes through the window of the hospital wing. And then they go down into the field overviewing. And then when they rush back to the hospital wing after saving,
Sirius
and thing. But it pushes right back through that window the other way.
Yeah,
the camera goes that way. It's just like such a nice tight cap. And it's all these like little decisions that just elevate this movie more. Because I would argue that the Harry Potter film franchise is as a whole, a giant step down from the book series. Like
It's
not even close. And I think
there's very few books that are as good as the movies. Limited.
It's limited, but this is the one movie that I think actually lives up to that book. I think so. Okay. We deal with a whole. Do you not agree with that, Dallin?
No. Well, I have a very curated list. I only think
I'm not talking about this series. I'm just talking about this movie.
I think there's only two movies ever that are better than the books. So like,
which was that what Timmy asked?
Yeah,
that was not my question.
What did you say? Does this live up to the book? I'm asking,
does this movie live up to the book?
No.
To the Prisoner of Azkaban book?
No. I don't think any movie lives up to the book except two of them. That's what I mean. You know? Like, yeah, I think it's great. I think it's one of the better, I think it's certainly in the upper echelon of all the videos of the Harry Potter series, without a doubt. But I don't think a single one of them lives up to the books.
Okay. I mean, that's fair enough.
No. It's like, I just, very few videos live up to books.
So to go on, I do want to mention this, the one part we haven't touched upon. I did like the Dementors in this. I thought that was cool.
They were great.
The exposure I've had from the Dementors is Michael Scott in The Office saying the worst part about prison was the Dementors. He's Prison Mike. that's my sole cultural osmosis.
When they actually
came in, I was like, oh fuck yeah, like, that's cool. little creepy dudes. And like the intro of like how like Alfonso Cuarón directs it, where like you go in and you see the Dementors. Like pretty much all the ghosts
pull the face, like
and
the way
everything
they
becomes like blue and everything like that. Just the color palette changes completely. Yeah. I thought it was a really cool touch. One of the few bright spots for this for me in this movie.
Sucks all the warmth and happiness out of a place, and that's a nice way to depict it visually. You know,
that's what we call me covering a Harry Potter movie on the podcast.
Everyone around him is like, I feel cold.
Tommy, I do have to say the prison Mike reference is spot on. Just that's A+ reference. I can tell we're losing you here a little bit. Like I can tell you're like, I'm ready for Tim to make the transition here whenever he wants. But I can tell that you're. That's what you get for going on a bunch of tangents instead of talking about the movie. It just goes on longer.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. It's like spot on with the Dementors, and just like I think one of the issues of the series in general, like in Voldemort, he's like, and I think it's just an issue of like big bads in general. They just tend to have this issue of like they're this overarching evil that lingers out there, but it's not super focused on the character itself. Like it was trauma in Harry's past, but it's not super focused, and his scar hurts, but it's not like super focused on Harry in a way until the later books. In this one, it's like the challenge he's actually facing is he can't control himself around this, and it's because of that trauma. So it's intertwining all that like past history he's had with these new prison guard creatures that seem to be that have just a different effect on him than they do on everybody else.
Well, that's the beautiful high school part of it, where it's like, suddenly, like, what's your biggest fear when you're around your peers? Like, oh my God, why am I freaking out? Everyone else can handle this, you know? And they do that very well. Like, that kind of like shame, like, imagine like, what did I wear? Like, imagine showing up in bell bottoms at the wrong time in the 80s or something, you know, like it's just that, like it portrays that very well when he like faints and he's like, uh-oh, are you guys okay? Did anyone else lose consciousness? You know, it's nice.
It is nice. And, you know, I think one of the things the movies do struggle with is like introducing the side characters that fill the books with charm. And I think in this one, they really put the spotlight on, they give Lupin a lot of screen time and a lot of time. And I think it's a very good adaptation of that character. Whereas totally. I feel like in some of the other, in the other movies, they don't adapt the characters as well. And we kind of miss that charm and that feeling. And if you just watch the movies, you probably just go, why couldn't you just give it to this character? Like, why couldn't you just melt these into two parts? But I really like Remus Lupin in this as well.
No, Lupin was wonderful. He did a great job.
As a father, as another father figure for Harry, yeah. Who's always kind of searching for that.
Totally.
And I do love that scene in The Shrieking Shack where Lupin comes in, where we still think Sirius Black is the bad guy.
Yeah.
And then you think Lupin is on his side. And it's only for like a minute until we finally get the explanation of everything. But it's just this, it's like this, like I remember the first time reading it going, what?
Yeah.
Lupin? Like the whole time. Like it's so well done in the movie too. And it's
I wish Gary Oldman went deep. Like I wanted Gary Oldman. That's the scene I wanted Gary Oldman
for. That's the scene you needed Gary Oldman to be Gary Oldman. No,
I wanted him to have the composure and just start to see it crack. But when, like, just see it crack. And then he's like, you know, he's here, Remus. And then, like, I wanted that moment of magic. Because I thought Lupin was doing it. I think Gary didn't bring it.
Yeah, I agree. It is Gary Oldman that holds it down in the movie itself. Like it is him that. Because
that
like,
could have been the masterpiece moment. It really could.
Yeah, that could have been the cementing thing where it keeps that from being perfect. But I do think this is near perfect.
It's very, very good. It's not perfect.
I didn't say it was perfect.
I know that's sorry, didn't mean.
I am a star. I'm a star, I'm a star, I'm a star. I am a big, bright, shining star.
All right, who is the star of the show? Who gave the best performance? It's obviously not Gary Oldman, but Tommy, I will let you go ahead.
We didn't talk about him at all, and because I brought him up on Die Hard earlier, Alan Rickman.
Oh, yes, Snape.
I mean, he didn't have that much to do in this one, I feel like.
That's another big problem of the books versus the movies. He has a lot more to do in the books.
Yeah.
And in the movies, he's kind of very relegated to a side character, and it's such a good adaptation of the character that it elevates him into this more prominent role than he actually has in the movies.
Well, it's the thing that, like, about Rickman, like, ever since Die Hard, if Rickman knew how to do one thing in acting, it was how to make a fucking entrance. Die Hard definitely held that true in this one. Whenever he comes in, I mean, they just got so much juice out of that in the Potter movies, I feel like, of just Rickman just open up the doors, and it's like, it's the guy.
The blowing of the belloping of the cloak, just like, the way he would just whip that thing around.
He was fun in this. But again, like I said, not much to do. I mean, if I had to give, like, in terms of like performances, I'm not even sure where I'd start, to be honest. Like, maybe the kids are fine. I mean, it's the weird thing about these movies that you kind of see these kids, from what I've heard, become better and better actors and like slowly.
You definitely do. And you start to see their limitations, like, as actors, too. I think this is the biggest growth for Daniel Radcliffe of all the three in this one. When he goes into the scene where he's in under the invisibility cloak and he learns that Sirius Black was his godfather, with McGonagall talking with the Cornelius Fudge in the, what is it, three broomsticks. And then he comes out and he's just like, he was that friend. And it's like a little campy and a little overacting, but it's like this little bit of growth that he has. And I think the other scene is when he's talking to Hermione and they're waiting for their past selves to come out of the Shrieking Shack. And he's just like, this is my dad. You know, like, I saw my dad. He saved me. He was the one who conjured this Patronus. And Hermione's looking at him like, he's just so dead set on this idea that his dad saved him because it's just what he wants to believe. And for a 14-year-old actor to be able to portray that, I think it's very well done. Like, for that age there, I feel like the star of the show is Alfonso Cuarón here. Like, he establishes the Harry Potter visual style that's now in the theme parks. Like that, the visual language of the Harry Potter franchise going forward that even lives in, like, the Fantastic Beasts series, that set design and world design all comes from Alfonso Cuarón and his team and what they did on this movie. And, like, it is iconic. Whether you like the movies, whether you like Harry Potter or not, it's certainly distinct.
Easily the best part. I mean, like, the visual touches he does add to it in a movie that, like, I mostly didn't care for, if I'm being honest. But he was innocent for me, at least. You can definitely see, whereas, like, he definitely uses the launching pad to, like, make his career, like, expand. And to the point that now he has, like, pretty much a blank check to do whatever he wants, because he made the best Harry Potter movie. He made one of the more profitable ones, I feel like. And the fact that goes on and does Children of Men after this, and this complete passion project. I mean, every one of his movies since then has been an original story for him. And if he didn't do great in this, then he wouldn't have had that. He would have been like, I feel like some of the other guys in the Harry Potter franchise, I mean, who are the other directors right there? We have Christopher Columbus. David Yates, I feel like, just does YA shit at this point.
he doesn't add anything. And then the person that did Goblet in Order of the Phoenix did even worse, personally. Like, he is the one true standout director in this. And it's the only one that, like, I think the first two do capture a whimsicality to them, whether you like that or not, in a cinematic arena that does stand out. I do think this is the one that it's like, oh, there's a cinematic quality to this that none of the others have, though.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a level of care and polish to this one that the other movies do not. Dalek, is there any performance that stands out to you in this one?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, the big three, Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, and Emma Watson, I appreciate them. And I agree with you 100% that they grow through the whole franchise. By far, for me, you know, Alan Rickman, through all the movies, plays the best role, like, both on screen and being, like, true to the books. If I have to give a best performance, I feel terrible. What's the name of the actor who plays Remus Lupin?
I can definitely get that for you.
Yeah, I didn't look it up. I'm sorry.
I know.
I've only seen him in that one DC movie. That one wasn't great either. But I think he does a great job as Lupin in this one. I feel the shabbiness, the tattered.
David Thewlis.
That's it, him. I feel like the shabbiness, it feels true to the character. You feel he cares for Harry and, like, but he's scared and, like, yeah, I get the nuance, and I think it's really well done, especially, like, in the just kind of guarded, like, of course I care for you, but, like, you know, I'm caught in something bigger. Like, I know, you know, I think my best friend was a murderer who killed my other best friend and his wife. You know, he's a complicated man. And I think it comes across on screen.
Yeah, I agree. Also wanted to shout out very quick. Timothy Spall as Peter Pettigrew, just like this wiry.
Yeah.
Like, it's a heat check performance.
He's great as a rat.
Man, he's great as a rat. Shout out to him for, you know, making this guy a vermin, both literally and figuratively. As such,
100%.
Ah, are you ready, comedy partner? Waka waka.
Okay. All right. Would Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban work as a Muppet adaptation? Tommy, I just want your take. I want you to cast the entire Muppets cast as a Harry Potter cast.
Well, I feel like, first of all, the Muppets have had to do some, like, Harry Potter type bullshit over the years.
I don't know. This is like the post Muppet era, though. You know, like, this is when they're dormant. This is really popular.
there's a Sesame Street one where they did like Furry Potter and the Goblet of Fur, whatever. I don't know, I'm looking at that picture right now. So,
oh God, did Tom Sam the Eagle? Tommy, did you just click on a bad link?
No. No. This is what Google gets me on.
No, jeez. Turn on safe search.
Yeah. Safe search on. So
pretend it's your work computer.
First of all, yeah, exactly. Sam the Eagle is Snape. That feels like
definitely.
There's like a home run right there. And do you keep Harry Potter as like the one human? As like Daniel Radcliffe? Do you make Hermione Miss Piggy?
Yeah, you have to. There's like five Muppet females, and she's the most prominent
Scooter,
one.
Scooter is obviously, what's it called?
Neville.
I was going to say Ron Weasley.
No, I feel like...
Gonzo?
No, I feel like Fozzie Bear is a good Ron.
I could see that. Actually.
He's a bit of a comic relief. Dowling, you disagree, but... listen, this
I
is
don't
a.
Know. It's hard to do. I don't know.
This is a
works.
Very. I think. This
I don't
is a,
think it works. Snape as Sam the Eagle is perfect. If you can just have Sam the Eagle, Snape, and everyone else stays human, I'd do it.
I'm okay with that too. Okay, review time. Give me your score to five, Tommy.
All right, here we go. Harry Potter is a franchise I never connected with, and unfortunately, I can't say anything has changed. So I think Alfonso Cuarón does some good directing, but I just can't get engaged with this. I just get bored. It's like my eyes droll over the second I put on a Harry Potter thing. So I'm going to go... Honestly,
be careful. You got warned beforehand. Be careful.
I got one beforehand, and I'm probably going to break this warning. I'm going to go 2.5 out of 5. I think there's some good stuff here, but it's just not the franchise for me. It doesn't connect with me. I'm not saying that.
That's still, I honestly, that's higher than I thought you were going to give it. I thought you were going to give this like a 1.5. I'm surprised.
No, I do have to admit the directing was good, but like I feel like just the story and just the overall plot, just I don't give a shit. I just get disengaged. And this is what, a 1 hour and 2 hour and like 20 minute movie or something like that? Too long.
I don't feel that with this one at all. Some of them, yes. But also shout out the New York Knicks for winning the NBA Cup. Just wanted to shout them out very quick here for the fake in-season title. We needed something. It's been 50 plus years. They needed something. Dowling, what about your score time?
Okay. Do I enjoy this movie every time I watch it? Certainly. Am I ever going to watch this by myself? No. That's a 3.5 all day. Like, I love watching it with my family. If someone's never seen it and they want to watch it, I'll be like, oh, yeah, I'll watch it with you. I think it's a great movie. Certainly one of the higher scores, if not tied for the highest score for all the movies for me. Like, I'll first time it with anyone, you know, but like, I'm not rewatching this by myself.
I'm shocked. I thought that you were going to give us like a 4 or like a 4.5.
So I'm going to shock you. I'm going to give this a 4. I think this is easily the best Harry Potter movie. I don't know if it's particularly close. I think the visual flair and the pretty tight adaptation of the book to this is really knocks it out of the park. I think it has the best twist of all of them because all of them end up having a twist. It's got a little bit of that M. Night Shyamalan quality to them. I think there's a lot of points you can come into this movie, put it on if you like, if it's on cable or something, and just go, okay, yeah. Oh, we got the hippogriff scene coming up here with Harry riding. Okay, yeah. I'll watch it. And then you're sitting there and then you end up watching the rest of the movie.
Yeah, totally.
I think there's a lot of great jump points into this. I think it established a very cool visual flair that maybe isn't super accurate to the books, but I think works well for the visual medium. And I think it breaks up the mundaneness of the visual style that the first two do have. even though those films are whimsical, they feel a little bit mundane for the magical world. And I think this one, for something that's set contemporarily, takes this like 1920s style and just kind of says like, hey, the wizards are stuck in the past, so let's make their style just completely stuck in the past, you know, like they never adapted into the future the way that the Muggles did, right? So I mean, this film left a very iconic, left a legacy, and I think the film still holds up today. And Gary Oldman being the weakest part as Sirius Black is unfortunate, but easy to get over enough. So for me, 4 out of 5, really great movie. It's a fun one to watch with the family. It's a fun one to watch with the kids.
Totally.
And I think for if you haven't watched this in a while and you decide to go back to it on HBO or whatever, paying attention to some of the visual cues that I don't think really exist in the other ones, but do exist in this one, will elevate your viewing experience of the movie.
Yeah.
But all right. Dowling, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, so good to see you.
Harry Potter nerd on this one. We love having you on always.
Oh, it's always good to see you.
Tommy, any final thoughts before we wrap up this episode?
Well, thank you guys so much for listening. This is our 4th season doing the podcast, 4 years, which is insane. And we want to thank you guys so much for listening. But once again, follow us on social media at SceneItPod. That's on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok. And also you can find us on Blue Sky, podscene.bluesky.social. And leave us a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. Helps us out, helps us grow the show. And, you know, this is the end of our 2025 season. And we're coming back with some good movies. We're not sure which ones yet. But
we'll definitely come back with some good movies. But yes, enjoy Christmas. Enjoy your holiday season. Thank you all so much for listening. We'll see you next year.
Bye.